Hello, we're about to listen to another Bruin podcast, and this one is covering the topic of oil, which has been incredibly volatile this year. So we're glad to have the services of Chief Commodity and Energy Strategist at BCA, Bob Ryan, who is a returner to the podcast. But bear in mind, we can't guarantee sources from outside Bruindolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and future performance may differ from that of the past. With that said, on with the podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to this Bruin podcast, where we're joined once again by Bob Ryan, who is the Chief Commodity and Energy Strategist at BCA Research. So, Bob, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Guy.
I think it's obviously a really great time to be talking to you. We've had such an interesting few months in energy markets, and I think we can assume we're going to have a pretty interesting following months as well. So, perhaps you could start by just giving us a bit of background. Energy markets have obviously suffered a huge hit, or are suffering a huge hit to demand. What kind of response? How could you summarise the response that we've seen so far from the from oil suppliers?
The demand hit appears to be just massive, particularly in the second quarter here. We published some research today, looking at ways that we can, try to get our head around what we are observing. And about the only place that you can do that is with U.S. data, since the U.S. reports weekly their estimates for consumption, production, exports, imports, that sort of thing, and where they see inventories going. And it looks like, the trough of the demand hit in the end of the first quarter and the beginning of the second quarter was just enormous. In the U.S., where they have this high frequency data, from the very early reports, it looks like demand for all refined products, so that's gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, that sort of thing, was down about 32% versus the five-year average for this time of year. That is just enormous. You look at the U.S. market being a 20 million barrel a day per, 20 million barrels per day of refined product demand. You're losing 30% of that. So the U.S. alone accounted for, in that short period of time, about 6 million barrels a day of the total loss that was seen in demand, over that interval in the world. It's just amazing. 6 million of the probably 30 million. So yeah, 20% of the world's demand hit came out of the U.S., which makes sense because it's 20% of the total consumption. But it's reasonable to suggest that the total hit to demand globally would have been something like somewhere between 20% and 30% down. Not everybody was hit as hard as the U.S.
And that's pretty much travel demand, is it? Is that's the sort of variable factor and the factor that's been hit the most?
Yeah, transportation demand. So yeah. cars, trucks, and obviously, plane travel. The thing about jet fuel is that it's less than 10% of total demand globally, but it's just been decimated, the airline industry and the amount of jet fuel that's being sold.
So what have we seen then from suppliers in the face of that hit to demand? Obviously, the intention on their part is always to try and maintain some sort of stability of price, but that's pretty difficult in that face.
Yes, it's been a very rapid response. We got off to something of a bad start in addressing the pandemic early on in March, with the OPEC Plus or OPEC 2.0, as we call it, meeting in Vienna. And there was a mini market share war launched by Russia at the beginning of March, and then it was, reversed by April. So, that probably, added maybe, I don't know, 3 million barrels a day of excess supply to the market while it was going on. But the enormous hit would have been the COVID demand destruction that we're seeing. And the supply side has responded very, very vigorously. Once OPEC Plus had its act sorted out, they agreed to remove something on the order of 10 million barrels a day relative to their benchmark of October 2018. And subsequent to that, Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Kuwait added an additional 1.2 million barrels a day onto that. So, you saw a huge response there. Outside of OPEC, particularly in the U.S., you've seen probably another 2 to 5 million barrels a day. It's very tough to get a handle on it. Production removed or, shut in. So, the market is responding very quickly on the supply side when it comes to crude oil.
Can you explain how that's working with the U.S. then? Obviously, the U.S. is not historically a member of OPEC or OPEC 2.0. So, and it's typically a sort of market-driven energy supply type market. So how have U.S. production cuts come about?
Exactly as you state, it's been a market response. Prices have just gone low enough to destroy supply, in the U.S., as well as in Canada, Brazil, Norway. They all are, experiencing similar things. But in the U.S., it's particularly dramatic because the shale guys are the producers of oil out of the shale basins in the U.S. have been the primary source of growth of supply in the U.S. So they have felt the most pain. A lot of the smaller companies in that universe were very highly levered. They were barely profitable, if at all, ahead of this, exogenous shock, the COVID-19. And the market just took prices down low enough to force them to either shut down or to file for bankruptcy. We've already started to see that. Just this past week, the U.S. Secretary of Energy estimated that we could lose maybe 2.2 million barrels a day of U.S. production. So outside of, Saudi and, the OPEC plus grouping, the biggest part of that pain is being absorbed by the U.S. through the market system. There was a stretch there, Guy, you probably remember, and we may have talked about it the last time, where it looked like the Texas Railroad Commission was going to get back into the business of regulating production. That did not happen. Although the state of Oklahoma did get into the business of regulating production as it had in the past. So you had one instance where the government intervened in Oklahoma. But for the most part, it's been the market just going through these high cost producers and, literally forcing them from the market. I should also mention, you probably saw the negative prices we had as the May contract expired in April for WTI futures, which deliver in Cushing, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
That was just a stunning, display. I mean, there will be books and papers written about this, not least of which, from options markets, because the assumption in all of options theory until that point had been that prices could not go below zero. And, we had at one point prices, drilled down into minus $40 a barrel as the May delivery contract was going off the board 2 days before it was, set to go off the board.
Yeah, and there was, at the time, I think even as that expiry passed, there was plenty of speculation that we'd be looking at the same thing again in May. But as it turns out, we got prices sharply higher. So, where are we? What's driven that big rally?
A couple of things. The markets are pricing in additional demand coming back, I should say. There's been an enormous amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus deployed around the world in huge amounts, on the order of between 5 and 10%, even more of GDP is being put into the global economy in the form of fiscal and monetary stimulus. That is likely to persist. And, you know, once we do get out of lockdown, which is starting to gather momentum globally as well, you know, you're going to see not only the economy returning to somewhat normal state, but you're going to have all this stimulus in the system. So that should be very supportive of demand, you know, around the world as we go into the second half of the year. You know, that's what we're looking at. And, you know, we think that, you know, there's actually a risk that, you know, markets could overdo it. I mean, we could see a, you know, really strong recovery just as the production cuts are really, really starting to take effect. And we're seeing that now. And in our very most recent modeling, you know, we think that by the beginning of the second half, in the third quarter, we might be looking at OPEC 2.0, OPEC Plus, having to increase production, take some of the spare capacity that they've accumulated, which is on the order of 5 or 6 million barrels a day now from their shutdowns, take some of that spare capacity and put it back into the market, because, you know, we could be at a point where prices really take off, you know, if they don't. So that is going to bear watching. And, you know, we're in a funny time in the evolution of the market. As it is, we're going into an election in the U.S., presidential election, and you know, almost surely, as the mathematicians say, that Donald Trump will be banging on the table, demanding higher production so that crude oil prices don't get so high that gasoline prices then start taking off as voters are going to the polls.
Yeah, so before we come on to that, I've just got a couple of questions related to points you've already made. So, I mean, this specific issue with the negative oil prices was related to the fact that you had futures contracts approaching delivery. And so people who may have been speculative holders of futures contracts were faced with the prospect that they might actually have to take delivery of physical oil, and there were shortages of supply, shortages of storage space and things like that. So firstly, is that right? And secondly, is there now space for oil storage and stuff like that? Has that risk fully receded?
Yes. And a very good point. You hit it right on you hit the nail right on the head there. What we had was what appeared to be a very disorderly termination of trading in the May futures contracts last month. And what that implies is that the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME Group, which owns the NYMEX, where the WTI contracts trade, did not do a very good job of supervising its markets as these contracts were going to delivery. You had a very, very combustible mix, is what we called it, where storage was filling in Cushing. You know, the operators of storage generally like to keep their tanks below the 80% level so that they can accommodate emergency injections in the event that a refinery goes offline or something like that. And, you know, the storage level in Cushing, you know, around the beginning of April started moving up toward that 80% mark. It got there, it went through it. You had large retail interests that had no capacity whatsoever still in the market, the Bank of China being one of them, and some of these U.S.-directed retail investment vehicles. They typically roll out, but they were rolling out earlier in the month of April as opposed to later in the month of April, when the Bank of China was you know, left in the market with 2 days left to trade. You know, if you have a retail interest in the market at that time, something has gone terribly wrong. You know, the retail participant there in that case, the manager of investment products offered to retail investors in China, had no capacity to you know, take delivery of physical oil in Cushing, Oklahoma. But that's where they found themselves, with 2 days before the contract stopped trading, you know, standing for delivery. And it wasn't a huge amount, it was less than a million barrels. But, you know, there they were, and all of the liquidity in that delivery month contract was gone. Everybody had rolled forward into June or July contracts, and the only people left in the market at that point are physical participants who are literally just balancing the last bit of volume that they need to buy or sell against positions that are part of their physical systems. So, it really turned into a very disorderly termination of trading.
But the storage space at Cushing, Oklahoma now is back below that 80% level, is it? Or?
Yeah, we're at about 70-72% right now. So still not in great position, but we should continue to see that going down on the back of the production cuts that were made by suppliers, the physical crude oil suppliers, as well as the refiners. They throttled back on their demand for crude oil and have been draining their product stocks that had gone unsold. This was a lot of unintended inventory accumulation of crude oil that they were not running, as well as refined products that they couldn't sell. So, by reducing their, utilization rate of their hardware, they are draining their storage down, and they're making room to return to normal operations where they actually want crude oil inventory on hand. And they're going to want some product inventory on hand to get ready for the, what's typically referred to as the summer driving season in the U.S., which is the very high demand period that we are in going into, or actually are in. It unofficially kicked off over the weekend.
Okay. And then you mentioned the cuts that we've seen from OPEC and OPEC 2. I mean, what's the discipline like? I mean, in this environment where producers are obviously struggling financially, and now you've got the price going up a bit. Are they actually following through on the cuts that they've all promised?
So far, so good. Although just over the past day or so, markets have started to become concerned that Russia may be looking to restore production faster than the schedule that was agreed to. Would lead one to expect that they would be doing. What's also interesting is, some of these members of OPEC Plus, they're in very similar straits to some of these, distressed shale oil producers. Funding is not readily available for them. There's not a huge interest in coming in and developing their resources. So, a lot of them can't really ramp up production. We call these guys the other guys. And their production has been steadily going down, and these low prices are going to accelerate that. So, there's a lot of financial distress globally in the private sector, as well as at the government level for these states. The other thing that's important is that there's also some concern that the shale guys, now that WTI prices are in the low 30s, pushing toward 35, the shale operators are going to be very quick to restore their production. And it's not clear that we're going to see that either. You're going to continue to see a lot of firms filing for bankruptcy or selling assets just to stay alive. There is not going to be a lot of capital made available to them. We did an interesting analysis we've yet to publish, but the percentage of the S&P 500 that is made up of energy companies is down to 2.5%. In normal times, years ago, you'd be looking at something like 10 to 15% of the market cap of the S&P 500 was energy companies. Now you're at 2.5%. And that largely reflects an exodus of investors from the space. So that what you're seeing is that there is not a readiness to invest, in the equity of these producers. And that will restrain the rate at which they can grow their production.
So just so I understand that correctly, then you've got the price going up, an expectation that you might see a step up in production from shale producers. But if I understand correctly, they might not be in a position to increase their production because they've actually got to sell the assets rather than investing to increase the production because of the degree of their financial distress. Is that right?
That's right. The more levered firms, the smaller, more highly levered firms are exactly in that position. And the market has made it clear since about the middle of 2016, 2017, they will not invest in these companies unless they are profitable and unless they can return capital to shareholders. And that is true of the entire world. That is exactly the same story that you hear in every part of this planet when you talk to E&P companies. They have received that message loud and clear from investors. So it's not clear that a price rally would elicit this quick response of increased production. There's still the risk that you get another wave of COVID-19, which would again lead to lockdowns, which would again destroy demand and take prices lower. So they're very aware of that. They are going to be concentrating on repairing balance sheets and retaining the investors that they have. And if that requires them to sell assets, that's what they're going to do.
Okay. Now, one of the things you mentioned a few minutes ago was the president's interest in keeping energy prices low, so that gasoline prices are low, and to generate some much-needed, I guess, feel-good factor for the economy, which is obviously struggling more than he would like it to in an election year. But what can he do then in order to bring that about? Because as we mentioned earlier, it's not really a sort of government regulated market, is it?
No, it's not. But he does have a lot of moral suasion. As we saw in 2018 going into the midterm elections, if you remember, around May of 2018, President Trump started pounding on the table demanding that OPEC increase production because we were going into those midterm elections. And they promptly did. The Saudis took their production level from 10 million barrels a day or less in the first half of 2018 up to 11.1, I think, million barrels a day by November of 2018. And, gasoline prices remained very suppressed, which is what President Trump wanted. You may also recall that he switched the tables on them. He imposed sanctions on Iran, and then at the last minute, literally before the sanctions were due to kick in, he granted waivers to the largest importers of Iranian oil. So you had this massive increase in production in response to President Trump's demands that OPEC increase production. Then you had these waivers granted, and the market just, it tanked, it just collapsed, because now you had, the emergency to which OPEC was responding to, the loss of Iranian exports as well as Venezuelan exports, which were also being sanctioned, to full-on Iranian production and exports, plus this big surge in production from the Saudis. So we would expect, going into the presidential election, where Donald Trump is actually standing for re-election, that he will be pounding on the table again, demanding higher output to keep gasoline prices low. Because as silly as it sounds, Guy, elections are lost when gasoline prices go high.
Wow.
In the U.S.
So the stakes are high then. All right, well, let's draw to a close then and think about the long-term implications. There's this sort of saying amongst investors that the best cure for a low oil price is a low oil price, meaning that the supply is going to get constrained and the price is going to rise. And I guess from what you've been describing, it sounds like, if anything, that constraint to supply might be even more acute now than it has been in the past. Do you have a sense where the new equilibrium price might end up going?
Sure. That's exactly right. In commodity world, we say the only cure for low prices is low prices. And that's what we got. The IEA yesterday estimated that, the COVID price collapse was going to reduce investment in energy generally by $400 billion, I believe, this year. Biggest share of that was going to be in oil and gas investment, which is going to be down about 32% year on year for 2020. So that's a huge amount of capital that is just not going to be deployed in the energy sector. So what it looks like is, we could be setting up for a very tight market in the medium to longer term. by 2022 to 2025 in that neighborhood, because you're taking out millions of barrels a day that would have been made available to the market, had those investments been made and continue to be made in 2020, 2021, 2022. So longer term, you could see significantly higher prices as the supply side retrenches and as the demand side gets back to normal. Over the short term, to the end of this year, we're expecting prices to average $40 a barrel for the year, and be pushing toward 50 by the end of the year as we enter 2021. And for 2021, we're expecting Brent prices to average $68 a barrel, with WTI probably somewhere around $65 a barrel, as the supply cuts as well as the revived demand kick in. As we were discussing earlier, there remains real risk to the upside that we could overshoot that. And there is also still risk to the downside. Another round of COVID lockdowns would really to another big down leg in demand. If the economy does not recover despite all the stimulus that we're getting, if people just become very reluctant to spend and very reluctant to get back to life as normal, no going to the pubs, no going out to restaurants, no taking vacation, that sort of thing, demand cannot recover as we expect. Our expectation is that we are going to see a very strong rally in prices going into the end of this year and next year. But it could be more, it could be less. And, right now the uncertainty is just enormous around what that is going to play out of.
Okay. All right. Well, Bob, thank you very much for taking us through that. I think that's been a hugely informative discussion around how the energy market is set up at these extraordinary times. So thank you so much for doing that. And thanks also to all of our Bruin Podcast listeners. Hopefully you've also enjoyed that conversation. And we also hope that you will join us next time. Thanks very much.